Environment, Economic Development and Agriculture Budget Division for Tuesday, April 28th, 2015, will come to order. So we have two bills on the agenda today. We have a quorum, and is Senator Dietzick, I just saw her here, I know she was here. So, as soon as she comes in, we'll get started.
I was gonna say, is it marijuana oil or something?
Do we have a quorum?
Yes, we have a quorum, and I don't know what kind of bugs these are, but...
Flash war.
Oh, okay, I was gonna say, it's not the kind that you can record anything.
Quite a thrill having those on your desk.
Okay, Senator Dietzick, Senate File 698.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and members, for hearing Senate File 698. Senate File 698 is the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. Recommendations for projects to be funded from the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund beginning July 1st, 2015. Joining me this past year on LCCMR were Chair Tomasoni, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dames, and Senator Westrum. The LCCMR funding priorities for 2015 included foundational natural resource data and information, environmental education, water resources, aquatic and terrestrial invasive species, air quality, climate change, and renewable energy, methods to protect, restore, and enhance land, water, and habitat, and land acquisition for habitat and recreation. The LCCMR received 152 proposals from its request for proposal process, totaling approximately $126 million. We heard 76 presentations on a wide variety of issues. After a competitive multi-step process, we are recommending 65 proposals to receive funding. The proposals are asking for approximately $46,383,000 in funding from the trust fund. 32 of these projects, about half, are considered statewide projects. These statewide projects provide best management practices or research that can be used statewide or have statewide implications. You have several handouts in your packet. Let's see. They kind of look like this. The first handout in your packet is the biennial report. Then you have a sheet that has some process information, summary information, and a breakdown of recipients and recipient categories. There's a list of recommendations for funding. That's a multi-page packet. And then you also have a summary and map of proposed acquisitions. So, in the breakdown you will see, we are recommending 19 proposals related to foundation, natural resource data and information, totaling almost $13 million. These projects include the production of county geological atlases, the Minnesota Biological Survey, the Minnesota Native Bee Atlas, updating the National Wetland Inventory for Minnesota, and digitizing the Minnesota Biodiversity Atlas at the Bell Museum and the historic Gullion Ruffled Grouse Research. Other proposals in this category will look at the effects of grazing versus fire for prairie management, the movement and seasonal habitat of Minnesota elk, and the impact of white nose syndrome on forest habitat for the endangered bat. Several of these projects are continuing efforts, and others are building off of previous studies. These projects provide inventory and help with planning efforts, provide critical information for land use and policy planning decisions. We are recommending 9 proposals relating to water resources, totaling about $3 million. Some of these projects are assessing water-related risks, whether it's the scarcity or abundance of water, to industry, municipalities, and ecosystems. Assessing the presence of emerging contaminants in Minnesota lakes, developing tools to remove pollutants from the lakes, and improving ability to accurately quantify sediment loads. We are recommending 5 proposals for about $1 million for environmental education, including providing hands-on learning experiences to students to understand watersheds, water resources, and water quality, and a proposal to increase awareness on alternatives to lead ammunition for hunting to protect wildlife from accidental lead poisoning. I believe this project has a wide range of supporters, from the DNR to Isaac Walton Lake to Deer Hunters Association. We are recommending 4 proposals for approximately $6 million relating to aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive species. $5 million of that funding is for the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants Center. We funded that one in LCCMR and through the legislature last year. The goal of the center is to develop new tools and techniques to eliminate, reduce, mitigate, and prevent destruction, expansion, and damage done by terrestrial invasive species. Terrestrial invasive damages are forest and urban landscapes, pests, by fruit and grains. The economic impact to Minnesota is about $3 billion annually. 24 trust fund dollars are being used to conduct a risk assessment and launch initial prioritization, and this request is for additional support for multidisciplinary research teams. The remaining $1 million in this category is funding to continue research to develop strategies to increase the resilience of the $1 billion ash trees and the ecosystem potentially impacted by this little bug, the emerald ash borer. So this would cause huge impacts if it gets into the Boundary Waters Canoe Area and the Superior National Forest. It will also, this money will also be used, hopefully, to develop a biological control for Canada thistle, the most prevalent invasive plant in the state, and research on how to stop a new emerging threat that has been recently found in the Winona area, the Hydrobasidian, which is an invasive root rot fungus. It kind of looks like a mushroom. And it attacks white pines, is considered the most destructive disease to conifers in the U.S. We're also recommending four proposals for approximately $3.3 million related to air quality, climate change, and renewable energy, including an ambitious project involving University of Minnesota Morris to develop and demonstrate alternative, renewable, and sustainable new technologies for producing nitrogen fertilizers, a proposal to collect comprehensive data and analysis of energy systems to develop future energy strategies, and a proposal to develop a model for building deconstruction to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce landfill waste, and provide job training. We are recommending 11 proposals for about $4.65 million to protect, restore, and enhance land, water, and habitat, including the final phase of the Minnesota Conservation Assistance Program to provide assistance in enrollment and retention of private lands and conservation programs, a proposal to identify key areas in the North Shore streams that are essential to sustaining trout fisheries, and a program to collect, preserve, and enable conservation of at least 15 species of Minnesota's native orchids. We are recommending 11 proposals for about $14 million for land acquisition for habitat. About $9 million of that is to the DNR for scientific natural area acquisition and restoration, stewardship and prairie bank easement acquisition, metro conservation corridors, wildlife management acquisition, and state parks and trails land acquisition. Other projects in this area include the Mesabi Trail in the Range, Metro Park land acquisition, securing permanent easements of high-quality habitat areas in the Leak Lake watershed, in collaboration with Crow Wing and Cass County to protect lakes in the North Central Lakes area, and developing a conservation easements assessment evaluation system. In addition to the 65 proposals we are recommending, we are requesting time extension for seven proposals originally funded in 2011, 2013, and 2014. These projects are not requesting or receiving additional funds, just additional time for completion, mostly because our funding starts in July, which is mid-planting and field season in Minnesota. We are also updating language related to the peer review process used to evaluate the proposals. Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment that corrects a typo. Hopefully you have that.
Okay.
That corrects a typo on page 27, includes the seven projects extensions I just talked about.
They will distribute the A1 amendment. Senator Dietzick on the A1 amendment.
It literally is just extensions. We've done this before. Examples are, one of them is a Marla Spivak pollinator project at the U. There's measuring hydrological benefits for the Glacial Ridge habitat restoration. We have one for Minnesota River Valley Green Corridor SNA area acquisition, one relating to detecting and monitoring carp. And then on the back side, we have one for Wilderness Inquiry. So this is literally just time extensions is all they're asking for. So I move the A1 amendment.
Any questions or concerns about the A1 amendment?
What's the priority?
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dietzick, could you explain to me what the provision on line, page 1, line 30, 31, 32, and then page 2, line 1 and 2 is doing? Your enhancing pollinator landscapes. I was just curious what all is going on with that.
It's a Marla Spivak proposal from last year. She's a bee researcher at the U, and I will ask Susan Thornton, the LCCMR director, to give more.
Ms. Thornton, just say your name for the record.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Tharton, Director of the LCCMR. And as Senator Dietzick explained, these are projects because of field seasons, delays, and so forth, needing more time. The appropriation, as you cited on starting on line 1.3, is to help do the B-Lab at the University of Minnesota. You know, they just needed more time to hire staff to get the work done. And was that the only one you're asking about, Senator Skoy?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Thornton. I understand what you're doing, and I have no more questions.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, then Senator Dietzick moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, members. I also wanted to let you know about an executive order that was issued earlier today by Governor Dayton. This executive order is also in your packet, I believe. It's Executive Order 1510, halting the practice of placing radio collars on moves in Minnesota. Placing the radio collars on the adult moves and their calves was funded by the LCCMR in 2013 and 2014. There have been some stories in the Strib, the Pioneer Press, and I think the Elaine Timberjay. They have raised concerns about the project. So originally the plan was to have the DNR here come today to discuss the project. But this order basically discontinues the collaring at this time. It is my I just wanted to make sure that you're all aware of it. It is my understanding that there are about 100 adult moose that still have collars. The DNR will continue to monitor these animals with the hopes that it does shed light on why the moose are dying in Minnesota. The DNR will work with LCCMR staff to adjust the work plan to reflect those changes. We do not need a legislative amendment at this time for the change. And I believe the DNR is here to answer any questions if you have any.
Any comments or questions? And there is money in the bill for the moose monitoring.
It was in the, Mr. Chair and members, it was actually in the 2013 and 2014 bill.
Okay.
And so there is still money left over from that, and they will use that to continue monitoring the 100 moose at this time.
Okay. Senator Ingram.
So, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Dietzick. I've been following this somewhat closely here, the moose situation, and understand the governor's. Can you tell me what's going to happen with the moose research if we're not going to be collaring the smaller animals? I'm not quite following what kind of research is going to be done with them.
I'll ask. I don't see the
DNR here or
here. Oh, here he
Mr.
comes.
Mayor. I think they're going to live now.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, members,
hand the microphone over to Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Senator Ingebrigtsen, your question about what's going to happen to the moose now, Senator Dietzick was correct. We have approximately 100 adult animals collared. We will continue monitoring them, so we will be tracking their movements. We'll be able to tell where they are, if they do go down, pass away, we will be able to identify the location and get there as soon as we can. Part of the research proposal was to be able to do a necropsy on these animals if they were killed or if they passed away, so we can get there right away before they decompose to try to figure out what's killing the animals or taking them down. So rather than continue collaring, we will be tracking, monitoring, researching, continuing the research work at that level.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer, so obviously the collaring of the baby moose was not working. I mean, the mothers were rejecting. That's what I gathered from the research that I have done. So we're not doing anything specific anymore than for the juvenile moose research.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, as of actually several months ago, all collaring of moose stopped, and then the executive order prohibits that from moving forward.
That's adult moose as well.
Yes.
But the ones that are installed are going to continue to monitor.
Mr. Chairman, members, correct. And that's exactly what the author was speaking of. We'll be working with the LCCMR to adjust our work plan activities and deal with it at that level.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, how many moose is that are still collared?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, about 100 right now. 99, I believe. But.
Okay. Any other comments or questions on this? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And any comments or questions on the bill? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, page 24, the State Parks and Trails land acquisition Metropolitan Regional Park System Land Acquisition Phase 4. Can you give the members a little idea? This is Phase 4. How much have we spent so far? And has there been any discussions at all with the LCCMR with regards to purchasing land by use of eminent domain? I know that's been a topic recently with regards to some of the legacy funding.
Is Thornton the eminent one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbretson, so through 2011, the existing appropriation is about $3 million. In 2013, it's about $1 million. These are willing sellers. It's not through eminent domain, so we are looking for willing sellers. I also believe there is a 40% local, well, that's in state trails, in the metro trails land, which is similar. It's willing sellers. There's a 40% match from the local group.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the bill? Okay, seeing none, then Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 698 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance as amended. All those in favor, any other comments or questions? Anybody need to comment on the bill? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Senator Sparks. Senator Sparks, Senate File 736. I think you've been through some other committees with this and had quite a bit of testimony. So, and we have some people that are going to testify, but go ahead and with your presentation. Let us know how you want to proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 736. Members, the rule has changed dramatically since we started regulating landline telephones, and it continues to change at a rapid pace. Considering the changes in the telecommunications industry, it seems reasonable that we reevaluate the way we regulate the participants within this industry. Mr. Chair and members, I would like to start by moving the A-12 amendment. And I can, as members have that handed out, I can explain it if you'd like to, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we wait till we get it, and then okay. We'll let you go ahead. Okay, Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chairman, we've been working on two reform bills this session. One is referred to as the VoIP services, and one dealing with traditional wire line providers. This amendment would separate out the VoIP provision, focusing the bill on the policy provisions regulating landlines, and includes some clarifying language brought to us by one of the stakeholders. We've been working with the Department of Commerce and others to continue to refine provisions in this bill, and are negotiating the inclusion of call completion language with the department has worked on and would like to adopt this amendment so we can continue to work toward agreements on this policy change. So, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I would ask members to support moving the A-12 amendment.
Senator Engelbretson, on the A-12 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, would there be any interested parties that would like to comment on it at all? I mean, it's fairly lengthy.
Are there any comments on the A-12 amendment? From anybody in the audience? I don't see anybody jumping up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, seeing none, then Senator Sparks moves the A-12 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, members, and I would like you to note that we've been working on this bill for several years. We had two lengthy hearings in the policy committee where it received strong support within that committee. I realize that there are a number of parties interested in being heard on this legislation, so I'll turn it over to testifiers and I can offer some additional comments at the closing. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to let Brent Christensen, the President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, tell you a little bit about the legislation that's before this committee.
Welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record, please, and then continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I'm with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We're a trade association that represents 42 what used to be landline telephone companies and are now broadband providers. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and talk a little bit about what this bill does and what it does not do. What this bill does not do is deregulate the telecommunications industry. There's been a lot of hype about it. There's been a lot of phone calls to legislators about it. And I think Representative Kreisha, who's the chief author in the House, probably put it best when he said when he gets a call from a constituent telling him that this bill is going to deregulate their landline service, the first question he asks them is who is their service provider? And the majority of the calls he's gotten, they've told him it was a cable provider, a wireless provider, or a voice over internet service provider. And when he does, when they answer that question, then he says this does not apply to you. This bill really only applies to the incumbent carriers that have been regulated the same way as a monopoly utility. And the reality is we're not a monopoly utility anymore. We live in a competitive environment. What this legislation does, it gives us the opportunity to go to the Public Utilities Commission, demonstrate that we're in a competitive environment, and then be regulated like our landline competitors. Now, not regulated like the voice over internet providers, not regulated by the cellular providers. They still have a much lighter touch than what we've got. But it does mean that we are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission in the same manner as our landline competitors. This does not diminish or decrease consumer protection. It does not diminish or decrease competition. And it does not encourage price inflation. There, you'll hear a lot of testimony and a lot of arguments that if you take the thumb off the incumbent providers, then the local phone rates are going to go through the roof. First of all, this only applies to competitive areas. And second of all, that doesn't even make sense. Competition drives prices down. It doesn't raise them. And all you have to do is look at the cellular industry to see evidence of that. This doesn't diminish or decrease expectation of quality of service. That's still regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. And it does not disrupt universal service. The majority of my members receive Federal Universal Service Fund, and the FCC determines what the local service rates are, the floor and the ceiling. Right now, the minimum that you can charge if you collect universal service funds is $20.65 a month, and the most is $30. That isn't going to change by this bill at all. What this bill does do, it promotes consumer choice, continued compliance with consumer protection laws on disclosure, anti-slamming and cramming. The Public Utilities Commission retains authority to investigate matters brought forth by telephone companies, government agencies, or response to consumer complaints. Among many others, this includes price and service complaints. There's still a requirement to file tariffs with the Commission detailing prices, terms, conditions of residential and business service offerings, and it provides authority to re-regulate areas in the event that the competitive dynamics change. Minnesota still retains regulatory assessments, service contributions to 911, TAP and TAM, and other funds are still included in that. You're going to hear testimony, and I pretty much do it for him if you'd like to save us some time. This is, I think, our fourth stop this train. Complaints about service quality, that the service quality is not going to be the same. Well, as I stated, the Public Utilities Commission still retains service quality. You'll hear testimony that there's carry of last resort obligations that go away, and that my members will be able to disconnect people just on a whim, and that's not true. Those carrier of last resort obligations, while they're not specified in law, do show up in PUC rules and will still have to be adhered to by the incumbent carriers. Billing and disconnection rules that apply to the ILEC that opt into market regulations still apply. The competitive test here is a loss of 50% of residential households. Well, once you've lost 50% of the market, I think you can be safely assured that there is competition. So with that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Christensen? Senator Dietzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you're the right person to ask. I'll be honest, I've gotten emails on this bill. I haven't paid too much attention to it. But why am I getting all these emails saying that people's landlines are at risk? And especially in rural, and I'm getting them and I'm not rural.
Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't really pay attention.
Well, I think that'd be a better question to ask AARP and Attorney General's office. I think they're the ones initiating that media blitz, and they're doing a good job of it. The reality is, it's just not true.
Follow up. So you're not going to disconnect the landlines or disconnect service I mean, if you have in certain towns, you know, you have the town here, and then you might have somebody that lives on a farm 20 miles here, or somebody that lives on a lake over here, and there's a whole bunch, you know, 20, 30 miles down, there's maybe five there. So it is expensive to go and run, especially if you're upgrading facilities, but just even keeping the landline going, you know, here and going in there, and that is, you know, there's differences of what is defined. Does it get into what is the defined service area? Is it just the town, or does it go out? So are you going to, does this bill keep that, where that person that lives out on the farm there and that lives on the lake, they, you know, service would still, they still get service on via landline if that is what they want. In some areas, you know, especially up in Senator Tomasoni's area, there, you know, cell phones don't necessarily work. In my area, cell phones don't always work.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, that's absolutely correct. The rules, the state rules that are in place that govern telephone companies in that situation aren't being changed at all. We still have to abide by those. But more importantly, we have carrier of last resort obligations at the federal level and the FCC, and that's obviously not being touched by this at all. So when we receive universal service support to serve those hardest to serve areas, that's not going away. And my members invest a lot of money, in many cases, fiber all the way to that farm site or close to that. They're not going to abandon that. That's not going to walk. They're not going to walk away from that. That doesn't make sense. We are talking about landline telephone service. Now, there are areas where it is cost prohibitive to upgrade those lines to be able to provide broadband. And we've been working with Senator Schmidt and others to try and get some state help to do that, to upgrade, but not to eliminate the services that are already there. If you want to disconnect a customer now, you have to go and basically ask permission from the Public Utilities Commission to do that. That does not change.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. I understand that CenturyLink presently has a docket in front of the Public Utilities Commission. I have some information here that says that is a request to repeal or diminish standards on restoring service, preventing outages, telling people when service will be disrupted for repairs or maintenance, and making sure bills are accurate. That in the docket, they have said that they don't want to expend resources to protect a landline customer base, instead use it for more customers who want advanced services. And I believe someone from your organization has said that change the service quality rules so that companies don't have to address telephone problems before broadband problems. So in light of that effort and thrust at the PUC, what are we to make of this proposal in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I'm probably not the best person to speak on behalf of CenturyLink. I'd be very uncomfortable to do that. I can tell you what I've said before about that and about that docket. Right now, the rules that they have to live by put telephone service in a different category than broadband service, and CenturyLink doesn't have the opportunity to address those on an equal basis. Beyond that, I would defer to someone from CenturyLink to answer that.
Somebody so. From CenturyLink here.
There's, Mr. Chairman, there's several people.
Yeah, they're in one of these conferences right now. So. Welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record.
Patrick Haggerty with CenturyLink.
Okay. Go ahead. Did you hear the question?
Could you restate the question, please? I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, first, Mr. Haggerty, are you in support of this bill? Are you hoping that it passes?
I am.
So in light of the fact that there's a docket in front of the PUC that is looking to, I won't repeat everything that I just said, but in effect, downgrade the level of responsiveness and service standards that CenturyLink is currently held to, changing, and their trade organization as well has been quoted as seeking to change the service quality rules so companies don't have to address telephone problems before broadband problems. In light of what Mr. Christensen just said, how are we not left with some of the questions that Senator Dietzick just raised, that this isn't an effort to diminish service quality?
I guess my response, Chairman, committee members would tie into Mr. Christensen's comments, and that is an effort to create parity amongst providers within the industry. In terms of regulatory oversight obligations requirements, we believe the marketplace has come to a point in which the marketplace is determining the level of service, the rates, the other elements that previously in a more monopoly environment regulation was required. So the docket at the PUC that you reference is very similar to, in terms of conceptually, is very similar in terms of what we're trying to accomplish here, is a level playing field, the ability to compete on a fair basis with those other providers within the market.
Mr. Chair,
So you're communicating to us that you're comfortable should the PUC, in fact, act affirmatively on your request to reduce your standards on restoring service, preventing outages, letting people know when service will be disrupted for repairs or maintenance, and making sure bills are accurate. Is that correct?
Mr. Hagerty.
Yeah, I believe if there was a decision to be made that a company such as mine, CenturyLink, would be regulated in the same way our competitors are regulated, that we'd be satisfied with that.
And that sounds like a yes.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I guess relating to that, one of the clear distinctions I think we need to set forth, but Mr. Christensen or the gentleman from CenturyLink comment if I'm stating anything incorrect, but one of the things is PUC evaluates whether there's a competitive marketplace, and I was part of the conference committee over 10 years ago that we allowed in areas that were competitive to level the playing fields, and as long as there was two or more competitive providers, and we delineated at that time St. Cloud and Duluth, which everybody agreed was a competitive environment, to be subject to less regulations. And this bill is kind of an extrapolation of that Senator Sparks has. But in our rural areas, I'm also aware that there's places that they're not going to have a CLECT come in, a competitive provider that competes, because it's just the nature of rural small town services. But in places where we can bring competition in, then we're talking about leveling the playing field so both or more parties that are providing that type of service can have the same type of reaction to a customer in the competition and the sales that they might offer or promotions they might offer. And so I just want us to be clear that, you know, there's places in our state already that have a competitive marketplace, and this would allow for more of that where there's a competitive marketplace, and the PUC would be involved in determining whether there's a competitive marketplace. Most of our business services now are deregulated and aren't subject to the same consumer and the PUC oversight as our residential, because it's in many cases it's deemed that they have competition, and the competition will therefore be its own regulator of customer service, because that's the very nature of competition. But in places where you don't have competition, then you still have a regulated monopoly, which is the purpose of the PUC. So Mr. Christensen or Senator Sparks, if there's anything that I've stated incorrectly, I'm happy to be corrected, but that's my understanding of this, and I just wanted to give people that perspective. This is kind of a next step or an evolution of what is in many places going on already in our state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, what you're referring to over 10 years ago, and I'm sorry to say I remember it, is we deregulated, the state of Minnesota deregulated four or more business lines in a couple serving areas in large metropolitan areas in Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, I think were the three outside the metro. And that the world didn't come to an end. regulation didn't, the lack of regulation for four or more business lines didn't cause business customers to suffer. And as a result, a few years after that, about 4 or 5 years after that, that was extended to be statewide. So today, four or more business lines are not regulated at all. And this bill is a very minor step towards that direction. This bill basically, for the majority of my members, just acknowledges that there's competition. Just to Senator Dietzick's earlier point, if there's not competition in that exchange, now we started off with this bill statewide. So for a large company like CenturyLink that operates all over the state, this would apply everywhere to them. For some of my smaller members, it would just be their serving areas. It's now worked its way down in the negotiation process, so it's just on an exchange basis. So if you have a very rural exchange where there isn't competition, this would not apply at all.
Senator Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to give you an idea of the telephone companies in my district. They are the heart of some of my small towns. They are what has made some of my small towns successful and what has made them thrive in areas where they maybe even shouldn't have thrived. But they employ people in the town, and they donate in our town, and they make our town, they bring businesses in for what they do in our towns. And so I don't want them to go away. We have a little Cross Lake Telephone Company that's it's an amazing asset to that community. And I have a little Emily Phone Company. And all these, the small telephone companies, they are really the heart of some of our small towns. And they need to be competitive in order to survive. And I do want them to thrive and survive, because in greater Minnesota, we work really hard on the job market. In Brainerd, we have some of the highest unemployment around. And we know that that group has got some broadband grants, and they're working really hard to make sure that people can live and work in our communities and do so successfully. So I would urge your support of this bill. I think it's really important for us in greater Minnesota that our companies do thrive.
Any other comments or questions? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just trying to understand this. My mother lived in Bedette, and that's 300 and some miles from here. So she had a pacemaker. So when she would need to have her pacemaker adjusted, I would drive there, and then I would drive her to North Dakota, because that's where the nearest cardiologist was. But some people had pacemakers that needed a landline, and they could, I mean, a different brand of pacemaker that was adjusted with the telephone, with the landline telephone in her area. So what would this change for that? And I don't frankly know the name of the company of her area in Barrette, but what would this bill change in that process, where someone needs a landline and frankly, in my opinion, should be responsible or accountable to the Public Utilities Commission? What would this bill do that would change that ability?
Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scalzi, nothing. I mean, they still have landline service. It depends on who they get from their landline service and how the landline service provider is regulated. If they get it from up in Baudette, it could be a cable company. Schulberg Cable, I believe, provides service up there. I don't know who the incumbent telephone company is, but whoever that is, they're still going to have a responsibility to provide service. So that pacemaker is still going to be connected.
Okay. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. James Kennedy. Senator Westrom.
Just to Senator Scalzi's point, and one of the things I think that's helpful, at least it was for me years ago, Senator Scalzi, there's an ILECT and a CLECT. And what Mr. Christensen was referring to, there's always going to be an ILECT, meaning the incumbent local exchange carrier. That's the company that was started under the monopoly. CLECT members stands for competitive local exchange carrier. And so when you have a CLECT in an area, you've now got two or more competitors. The first one being an ILEC, which is what your mother, and in my hometown, that's all I have is an ILEC, because CenturyLink and other companies don't come into our small towns, and they weren't the original ILEC. And so those ILECs will stay. It's only if a CLECT starts coming into certain areas, Fergus Falls, for example, or Alexandria in my area, in Senator Ingebrigtsen's areas, have become competitive havens because there's enough population that some of our local small-town co-ops are actually in overbuilding as a CLECT in those cities. And this bill only affects when you start having a competitive marketplace. The ILECs that I referred to in Baudette for your mother or in my hometown of Elba Lake, everything stays the same. They're still the monopoly. They're still regulated by the PUC. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Senator Westbrook. Mr. Kennedy. Just say your name for the record and then continue.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is James Kennedy. I'm a Deputy Attorney General from the Attorney General's Office. The Attorney General's Office is strongly opposed to this bill. This is deregulation, and I know you've been told this is not deregulation, but I am here to tell you this is deregulation. And I hope I'm able to explain why I say that today, because this is a very important point. This bill dismantles the system we've had regulating the telephone system in Minnesota for 100 years. And this stands to affect affordability, reliability, and universal service for all citizens in the state of Minnesota. Let me make a couple of preliminary points. This bill is something that is strongly being lobbied for by the companies, and it's a big win for the telephone companies. Consumers and ratepayers don't get anything from this bill, and it's not just neutral. It stands to harm them greatly. And actually, I'd like to start by addressing the point that Senator Westrom was just talking about, because I think that is a helpful place to start in the difference between ILECs and CLECs, because that goes to the heart of what this bill does. Currently, we do have ILECs, which are the companies that were there in the beginning, and they're regulated under traditional regulation through the Public Utilities Commission. And then we have a separate system on the side for CLECs. And CLECs are subject to lesser regulation by the state in a variety of ways. And that makes sense under the system that we have now, because by definition, everybody under that lesser form of regulation is a competitive provider. And if those competitive providers do anything to harm people, that is, raise prices, offer poor customer service, whatever it may be, we all have an ILEC that we can go back to. For me, at my home, my ILEC is CenturyLink. I could elect to get service from a CLEC, and if I were unhappy with them in our current system, I have CenturyLink to go back to. And CenturyLink is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, and that includes price regulation. So I can get basic local phone service through a landline from CenturyLink for a price that has been set by the Public Utilities Commission. What this bill does is take CenturyLink and move it to the CLEC form of regulation. So when you hear that this is leveling the playing field and regulating them at the same level as their competitors, what that means is they're taking them out of the system that has regulated our phone system for 100 years and moving them to that lesser form of regulation. So when I say this is deregulation, that's what I mean. But let's get into the specifics a little bit of how that's going to change things. Prices are going to be unregulated, and that is probably the biggest change that's going to happen with this bill. Right now, the ILECs have to go to the Public Utilities Commission and get the price approved and set by the PUC. And there are a variety of ways that they can do that for telephone companies. There's traditional rate of return regulation. There's actually a lesser form of regulation available for telephone companies that differs from electric and gas utilities, for example. Telephone utilities can take advantage of something called alternative form of regulation, or A4, which is a more streamlined system that telephone companies already have available to them in order to set rates. What those telephone companies will move to under the CLEC system of regulation is being able to unilaterally set their prices. And this is one of the big reasons why telephone companies are strongly in favor of this bill and this change. because pricing becomes unregulated. Now, again, I want to go back to the initial point I was making. That makes sense to allow CLECs to do that, because if they raise their prices too much, everybody has the ILEC under the current system to fall back on. But that will no longer be true. In other states where this type of deregulation has been done, prices have gone up. That's what's going to happen if we allow our telephone companies to set prices without PUC control over those prices. So, for example, data in California suggests that after deregulation, prices went up 115%. One of the challenges to giving you good information about how much prices have gone up in a number of the other states that have dealt with this is, by definition, once we move towards deregulation, we all have a lot less information about pricing. That makes it very difficult for us to do comprehensive studies and tell you exactly what we can expect, but I can certainly say we expect prices to go up. Universal service is going to be affected. Universal service, to the extent any of us take that for granted, I want to start by saying I think that's because we've always lived in a state where we had universal service. I know you've been told that universal service is not going to be affected, that nothing is changing in that regard. But let me give you one example of why I say we're moving away from universal service with this bill. Under current law, ILECs are prohibited from discriminating based on price or with pricing. CLECs have a different form of price discrimination regulation that it will now be applicable to ILECs if this bill is adopted. And under the CLEC rules, price discrimination is still prohibited in name, but there are a great number of exceptions that are allowed for CLECs. So, for example, and this gets to some of the questions that have already been asked today, when we're talking about the people who live a great distance outside of town, if their service is going to change, and also when we talk about people who live in rural Minnesota who may have medical equipment and rely on landlines. It's possible for the telephone companies to sit before you and tell you that none of that's going to change. But once we allow price discrimination based on geography or based on the cost of serving customers, two things that this bill will allow for ILECs to do in the future, then it becomes a business decision for telephone companies to decide how much they're going to charge for service for the person who lives in rural Minnesota, a great distance away from the exchange or out on the lake. It becomes a business decision as to how much they're going to charge for service in Baudette or elsewhere. Right now, we're all guaranteed an affordable landline, even if it costs a telephone company a great deal more to serve a particular customer. That will not necessarily be true in the future. And that's where you chip away at our universal service. That's where it becomes impossible for people in greater Minnesota or senior citizens or many other people who rely on landlines for safety and security issues, for convenience issues. It becomes impossible for them to afford them. That's not universal service. Service quality is also related. Service quality is something that's highly regulated by the PUC right now. I brought with me just to show, here's an example of CenturyLink's most recent service quality report. This is trade secret information, but it's information that CenturyLink is currently required to file every year with the PUC. And in this packet, there's approximately, 50 pages here of tables and numbers and percentages that provide comprehensive information on a number of metrics as to how long it takes CenturyLink to repair a service that's got problems, how many times there are repeat problems with certain lines, how long it takes to install new service, how many customer commitments in terms of appointments were met by the company. Currently, under our current system of regulation, CenturyLink is required to report this information and is subject to penalties if they don't substantially comply with the commitments that they make on all of these various metrics. Under the bill that you're being asked to adopt, that would no longer be true. That would change this system. And finally, the bill would also affect the jurisdiction and authority of the PUC. Many things would become subject to PUC oversight by complaint only rather than direct regulation, as is currently the case. And the bill would also shift the burden to, for example, proving why the company's price is not reasonable instead of having the PUC with the authority to set pricing as it currently is. So those are among the concerns with the bill. Now, let me say one word before I end here about the competitive test that you've heard about. And the competitive test gets in, and I have to restrain myself because I also work in the antitrust division at the Attorney General's office. This gets into issues I know a lot about. And it's really difficult to come in here and provide a short version of the story as to why the competitive test is a problem here, but I'm going to do my best. And I'll start by saying it's a sham. The competitive test in here is not a test at all. The competitive test says that if there's 50% or less market share, then by definition, there is competition for the phone company. Now, that makes sense on the gut level, and I understand that. But that makes absolutely no sense on a technical basis in terms of finding if there is effective competition that's going to restrain pricing. And that's what matters, and that's what we should care about. When we look at determining if there's effective competition in a market and if it's going to constrain pricing, that's a highly technical test that looks at a number of factors. This test looks at market share only. And market share is perhaps part of the many factors that would be looked at in an antitrust and competition law environment, but it's one of many, and it's probably a footnote. It is not at all a test by itself. And that's what this bill does, and that's a very short version as to why this is problematic. I would also add CenturyLink's current information, as I understand it from the PUC docket that Senator Dibble mentioned, 92%, I believe, of their exchanges would meet this test currently. So I think that also explains why the telephone companies are in favor of this being the test. When 92% of their customers would meet this test, that would allow them to essentially enact this on a nearly complete basis immediately. Now, I would offer one specific reference to Minnesota law as part of this discussion about the competitive test. Current Minnesota law actually has a test in Chapter 237 that addresses competition that's very different than the one that you're being asked to adopt. It's at 237.761 Subdivision 5. And I'll repeat that again on the chance anybody's writing that down. 237.761 Subdivision 5. So the law in there isn't perfect, and I don't offer that up as a suggestion as something that you would adopt in lieu of the test in this bill, because I still think this bill has a lot of other problems that that wouldn't fix. The main reason I point it out is it's completely inconsistent to adopt a completely different competitive test into Chapter 237 when this section of Chapter 237 already addresses what is really the same question of what should be looked at by the PUC to determine if there is competition in the area of telecommunications. That test does do a much better job, I'll tell you, than the one that's being proposed here, because it tells the PUC to look at a variety of factors, to weigh them, and then to decide based on all of that information if there's effective competition that's going to constrain pricing or not. The test that you're being asked to adopt says 50% market share is all you need to look at, and if that's the case, there's an automatic requirement for the PUC to grant it. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to address these issues. As I said, the Attorney General's office has a number of concerns and very strong concerns about this bill. We urge you to reject it.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Any questions of the Attorney General? Seeing none, thank you. Senator Westrum. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, is it Jim? James?
James.
James. So, are you, because this bill in a small town with just an island, does it not apply? Is the PUC removed from those regulatory situations as well?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, so to answer your question, I think certainly the answer is that it could. And let me tell you the conditions under which it could apply in a small town with an ILEC. The bill in Section 3 defines competitive service providers at Subdivision 1. And this is where the problems with the bill start, because the definitions really determine the outcome here. Instead of the robust test of if there's actually competition that I'm suggesting we would need, this bill substitutes that by defining what we're going to consider to be competition. And in Subdivision 1 of Section 3, it defines competitive service providers to include wireless or VoIP providers. And then it also goes on to list satellite technology, CLECs, over-the-top VoIP providers, and others in the bill. I'm obviously paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
But for example, with that background to answer your question, you could have a small town with an ILEC, and there could be a claim by the telephone company that there is service offered by a wireless provider, cellular telephone service, and that there is service offered by Vonage or a cable provider in terms of VoIP service. Mm-hmm. Once we're to this point in the answer, I'd say here's the problem with that. As we all know, there are a number of areas of the state, including both outstate and the metro area, where cellular service can't be counted on to always be reliable and available. Even if it is, many people don't consider it to be a full substitute for landlines at this point. There are many things, many uses for landlines, including health needs and calling 911 and having them get your address and all kinds of things that don't apply to all other forms of telecommunication. When we start talking about VoIP, certainly that's a great technology, but we have important differences between VoIP and landline telephones. If the power's out, is your VoIP phone service going to work? That's not going to happen for everybody. If your neighbors are all streaming broadband video, is your network in your neighborhood going to be congested, preventing you from using your VoIP phone? That's possible with VoIP technology. With our telephones, we don't have to worry about, if our neighbors are all watching the season finale of something, is my phone going to work? But if we are all moving to broadband and relying on VoIP, that is something that we all have to start to discuss. And, frankly, that's a couple of levels into the problem. Let's start with the primary issue of, is broadband available for everybody in the state? That's an issue that's being discussed, in multiple places around this building.
So, Mr. Chair and James, to that specific question. And I hear what you're saying about the test, but isn't that part of where we relax the regulation, where we've got communities and areas that have enough of the healthy competition, but we also protect the small towns or the rural areas that are, but for the incumbent ILEC in the first place, they wouldn't have service, and but for the universal service. Don't we kind of reach that balance here?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I would say the healthy competition is the key to your question.
Okay.
If there were a test that were actually proposed that would ensure that there were reliable, affordable substitutes to landline telephone service to everyone in the areas where it would become regulated at the lower level, that would be an entirely different conversation, and this bill does not move us to that at all.
So to that point, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to discontinue then, I think. But you talked about the test of being less than 50% of the market share. So is that test set so the ILEC, if they've dropped below 50% of the market share, then that would meet the competitive test. But if they still are serving 60% or 70% or 80% of the market, measured by number of residents and businesses in that area or something, is that not a pretty strong indication? I know you said it wasn't, but talk to us about that again, because it seems to me if you have the ILECs continuing to lose this kind of service, 50% of your business is a lot of business. Where am I looking at this wrong?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that goes to the issue that I understand 50% makes sense on a gut level, but 50% or, frankly, any percent of market share does not address the critical issue that we need to address, which is the competition effective for constraining prices? Because if it's not effective for constraining prices, then it's not the type of competition that we can say, let's leave it to the market to regulate then. So instead, what we would need to look at is a detailed analysis of the product offerings available to the customers in that area, the geographic market area that we're talking about, and then look at the pricing of those. And this is, you know, in an antitrust case, if you sue out an antitrust case, the state of Minnesota recently sued out an antitrust case against Sysco and U.S. Foods. I use that as an example because at the beginning of any antitrust case, there is a lengthy process of determining geographic and product market where all of this is examined in detail, pricing data by economists, and analysis is done to determine if prices are being constrained. None of that will be done under just simply looking at a market share. And that's the reason why this test is essentially meaningless in terms of determining if pricing will be constrained.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Candidate, first of all, just because I don't know, and hopefully you can answer this, does this all of your testimony apply to a private service provider as well as a rural telephone co-op the same, or are there differences between those two service providers in rural areas?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, no, this is, my testimony does not apply equally to the rural telephone co-ops. There is a different regulatory structure for telephone co-ops and municipal telephone service, and so this would strictly apply to the investor-owned ILEX that provides service around the state.
Oh, okay. Well, that's helpful. And the reason that I asked that question is because when I look at communication in the rural area, my biggest fear is that the current mechanism for supporting these sparsely populated areas is the rural telephone co-op funding mechanism. And if that's to be modified, who's going to maintain the wires? Because you're talking about voiceover and all of that stuff, but somebody's got to take care of the wires coming into those sparsely populated homes. And I'm just curious as to how the impacts of this proposal would have on that.
Mr. Kennedy, you have an opinion on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say I appreciate the question for allowing me to make that clarification because we didn't start with that, and frankly, we've all had this discussion a number of times before we came to this committee, so it's tempting to just jump into the weeds on this, but I certainly would echo the clarification I made. The co-ops are generally regulated, self-regulated under a different system, and a number of municipal systems exist around the state as well. So we're not talking about those. I guess I don't have a direct answer to the question you pose, which is the maintenance of those going forward and rising prices, et cetera. But I appreciate the opportunity to clarify.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Mary Jo George. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mary Jo George, and I am the Associate State Director of AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify. We also want to thank Senator Sparks for trying to bring the stakeholders together on this bill, but unfortunately, we were not able to reach any agreement, and at this point, AARP must respectfully oppose this legislation. And I think as we have testified in the past, older Minnesotans are more likely than any other age group to have landline telephone service in their home, and they are the least likely to cut the cord. That doesn't mean, however, that they aren't also buying wireless products and VoIP products as well. We have CDC data that shows they do purchase both of those types of products. But, you know, instead of trying to, you know, repeat everything that you heard from James, I just really briefly want to say three things why we oppose the bill. You know, we are concerned that price deregulation will increase prices to the point where it could be unaffordable for those seniors who are on fixed incomes, because we know from research that other states that have price deregulated have seen some substantial increases, and I think the AG's office had mentioned that as well. But second, and I think this is fundamental to the discussion you guys have been having, is that we fundamentally believe in order to have competition, you do need to have products that are comparable in price, affordability, and reliability. And so you touched on that already, because today we do not believe, now this might not be the case in the future, but at least today, traditional copper landline telephones are not interchangeable with wireless and VoIP phone services. And so thus, we believe fundamentally that is where the bill, the fundamental flaw is in the bill, because you cannot set up a competitive marketplace between two products that really are not the same. And I think some of you have indicated that many seniors are relying on their landline for their pacemakers. We know that there are areas in greater Minnesota where cellular and internet phone service is spotty at best, and it doesn't work oftentimes in an emergency. And so really, to us, competition is meaningless if you can't rely on the service when you need it most. So I know there's confusion on the bill of whether or not there would be that service there, but we do not believe the competitive test is, you know, it puts too many people at risk, because we think customers are expected to choose from an alternative service that isn't as reliable. And then lastly, we do have concerns about the quality service rules that many of you have discussed already. So thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. George. Any questions for this witness? Thank you very much. Ron Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I just first want to say it's always difficult to testify in opposition to a bill from a legislator who's been always supportive of consumer protections and our clients. In fact, Senator Sparks is carrying a bill this year with the Minnesota Bank Association legal aid bill. And so I just want to acknowledge the difficulty of doing that. But I need to do my job, so I'm going to do it. And I just want to give some perspective. So who's going to be affected by all this? How many people? The company's own numbers tell us that there are 1.3 million landlines right now. That's conservatively 2 million Minnesotans, 2 million people affected. And so what's the big picture here? So to me, the threshold question is, what are going to be the impacts on those 2 million people? Will prices rise? Will service deteriorate? Well, so far, in the evidence from a lot of the other states that have done this, the evidence is prices rise, some very dramatically. And you've already heard from the testifiers, from the proponents, that they want to be treated like their other competitors, which provide poorer service. So here we are with a race to the bottom, and the idea being that competition is going to improve lower prices and improve service. Well, so far the evidence has been just the opposite. Prices go up, service goes down. And there are no guarantees, not a single guarantee in this bill that that won't happen here in Minnesota. So if we're going to change the regulatory structure that has served us so well for so long and that has produced affordable, reliable, and quality service, I, for one, would want some guarantees that we're not going to have that same result that's happened elsewhere. Further, another real great concern is what's going to happen to basic local service, the single line service, the service that everybody relies on and certainly our clients rely on primarily. Under the current system, those prices are somewhat protected, and under the current relaxed regulatory structure that already CenturyLink and Frontier and others have under the A4s, the alternative form of regulation that some of you have heard, they have actually promised, they've signed contracts with the state to say, in CenturyLink's case, through the end of 2016, and in Frontier's case, through the end of 2018, that basic service rates will only rise a certain amount, $1 or $2 a year. So what happens under this bill? You can take those promises or those contracts and rip them up, because as soon as this goes into effect, those are no longer effective and no longer those prices are protected. That's really concerning to me. The proponents suggest that service will not be threatened. Well, you know, there are a number of key protections already in our rules, billing against disconnections, service quality, notice provisions, dispute resolutions. They are all found in the Commission's rules under Chapter 7810. Look at Senate File 736 and see if you can find Chapter 7810 referenced. It is not. So therefore, I wonder, how are those incorporated? So all in all, I guess I would simply suggest to you that the verbal promises we have heard so far appear to be written in invisible ink. And I really would suggest that we move very cautiously here before we change this system. Thank you.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, so Mr. Elwood just said something that I think is a curious thing, and it would seem to me more regulation would dictate better service and lower prices, or more competition, I mean, would dictate better service and lower prices. And the claim is that where it's happened before, it's gone exactly the opposite direction. So can somebody give us some information about that and let us know if that's true or not? Go ahead, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Brent Christensen, Minnesota Telecom Alliance. Those examples that you're talking about in Texas and California, I'm familiar with, that was for metered telephone service. That was for buying a block of minutes. That doesn't exist in Minnesota. We don't offer that service here. And as far as Texas goes and throughout the country, I talked about this in my testimony, the FCC, through its 2011 transformation order, set the floor. So companies, and we had few in Minnesota that had local service rates that were like $3.75, they all had to go up to $20.65. And so that's being dictated by the feds, not by the states.
Mr. Elwood?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Christensen is partly right in that in California that the metered service was a large increase. But basic service also went up, and I believe the figure is 115% after the bill there. So I think that's only a half answer. And as far as the feds regulating the service, the bottom line is you've got protections here in Minnesota about how much basic service can be increased. Whether or not, if it's under rate of return regulation, that's one thing. Under these alternative forms, it's another thing. And they are capped at how much per month, per year under these agreements it can go up. Those would go away. And that is of real concern to the folks that I represent who rely on basic local service for their a basic single line service, your basic old, plain old telephone service. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll ask Mr. Elwood and Mr. Christensen, either one or both can answer. So is the I don't see in here, but it might be referenced in any of these sections, the telephone assistance program for low-income Minnesotans, do they pay, are they required to pay into that, or how does this impact that? Relay services and 911 fee surcharge, 911 surcharge fee,
Mr.
are they
Chair,
addressed
yep.
in any of this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, the Senate File 736 preserves the requirements of the phone companies to pay into those funds.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, on page 4, subdivision 7, reexamining the applicability of competitive criteria. So I'm reading this, and it looks like the commission, I'm serving the PUC, can, review upon petition or its own motion and call the you know, back to be regulated. So does anybody have an idea? Does that work? And has that been done in other areas? Or is there, it doesn't look like there's any listing of criteria of when you could do that.
Anybody have an idea what the answer to that is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any other states that have done that. That was part of the negotiation process with stakeholders to put that provision in.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. And Jennifer Shaba.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Maybe a question for Senator Sparks, because I gather I'm probably one of the few people that is new to this conversation, but it's the first time I've heard it, so I'm learning a lot. I just heard mention of a stakeholder group, Senator Sparks. What was the stakeholder group, and is this the result of their work, or what's that about?
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, it's a good question. As I said in my opening comments, we've been working on this for several years, and I would like to acknowledge that AARP was very active in those stakeholder meetings. Ron Elwood and Deputy Commissioner or Commissioner Grant was part of those conversations, too. We've come a long ways, made a lot of negotiations, and continue to try to find the sweet spot here. But the players have been very active and very engaged, along with the telephone companies as well.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks. So you've had a lot of conversations. It's you just haven't quite found it yet, is what I'm hearing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, I think that's right. I think we're getting closer and closer. We had over 4 hours of testimony in the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee, and again, we're just trying to continue to
push that. We're going to try and keep it to less than that here.
I hope so.
Mr. Chair, that's the last of my questions.
You can keep talking. If you want to talk, you can. All right, Ms. Shabak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I definitely will not be going 4 hours or any longer than that. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on Senate File 736 and the AFL-CIO.
Say your name for the record, please.
Jennifer Shabak with the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Legislative director, I apologize. Our general board did, or executive board, I correct myself, did take a position against both the VoIP bill and the telecom bills. And our reasoning here, and I know they've done some work, we took out some of the VoIP provisions, but there are still several concerns, and I will not reiterate all the great testimony by Ron and Mary and James. But, you know, one major concern for us really is the consumer protection part of it. Our members, our affiliates, are consumers. Many live in greater Minnesota. And the reference to the Chapter 7810, which, again, I'm not new to this conversation, but I don't know the technicalities. And so I literally printed out many of the statutes and looked for references, because that's what we all do. Does this chapter? And as far as I can tell, as Ron said, there is no reference to that. And one other suggestion, there was conversation earlier about leveling the playing field. But leveling the playing field doesn't make sense to take away good standards, quality standards, for one industry to move them backwards. You should maybe bring them all up to the level of that we're at now with regulation and consumer protections for everything. So I appreciate the time, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness? So I'm a little like Senator Scoy and kind of learning a little bit about this. And so this bill passes and gets enacted into law. And the PUC or the industry proves that there's been a 50% reduction in competition. Does that person up in Baudette who has a telephone wire going to their house lose that telephone wire, or what happens here? I'm trying to figure out what the effect of the bill is.
Mr. Chair, obviously I can let Mr. Christensen speak, but I would say, in my opinion, no, it wouldn't. Because the laws and the rules that protect consumers from loss of service and provide for the carrier of last resort are still in place under this bill. I would never bring a bill forward. Obviously, I come from a rural district, too, that has a lot of landlines and a lot of farmers. You know, we work closely with the telecom division and the Department of Commerce on what constitutes a carrier of last resort and state law, and all of them still would apply. So I would say that they'd have to petition the PUC in any instance to have that happen, and certainly before any service would be removed, they'd have to go through all those steps. Is that correct?
So the line could be removed?
No, Mr. Chairman, it could not. I mean, the Public Utilities Commission has a process in place to disconnect a customer, and that process remains in place. We don't get to arbitrarily just cut people off just because this bill is enacted. That's the same rule as that the CLEX have.
Well, you don't want to cut people off. You want to get more.
No, we want to get them. Yeah, I mean, it's
right?
Just, yeah.
I mean, that's not the idea here. So, all right. Any other? Senator Scoy. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on your question, though, because there are times when the price can do the same effect as cutting them off if it's more expensive and they can't afford it. And so that's the testimony that I've heard is, where is the assurance that currently is in place under the regulated system to assure that in these rural areas, and it's a real concern because they're very sparsely populated, and if they have to start bearing all the cost as a one house for bringing a phone line 8 miles, the costs are going to be pretty exorbitant. And so where's the protection from that? That would be my major concern.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoey, in that situation, there wouldn't be competition, and this bill would not apply. Those lines are not going to go away. The services provided are not going to go away. The reality here is, and let me just put this out on the table, we can want copper lines to stick around forever. They're not going to. They're being replaced by fiber all the time. Broadband is being deployed out. Landline telephone service as a standalone service is going away. There is nothing any of us can do to go with it. But those services, that pipe to your house that Garden Valley brings to you, that's not going away. That's going to be there, and the services that are provided on top of that, voice, video, in whatever form that is, and internet, are all still going to be provided. This does nothing to address that. Those lines are still there, and we can't operate in a vacuum. The other testifiers are trying to get you to focus on a vacuum of just the state. In our industry, and I come from the industry, we can't operate in a vacuum in the state of Minnesota. We're regulated by the FCC. They set the universal service term that Mr. Kennedy was throwing around, while technically correct, does not really apply to Minnesota. Universal service, the concept, is a federal concept, and it's a federal mandate to get landline telephone service to everybody. And they provide the funds that you all contribute to on your phone bill to make that happen. That's not changing. This bill does not do anything to address universal service.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Well, that's good to hear. And I'm you know, I understand now that the rural telco that services me is not going to be impacted by that. And I've had numerous conversations with some of the advocates for broadband, which isn't going to go away. I mean, copper might, but fiber probably isn't for a while. And, you know, I look at my rural telco, and I got fiber in my house and my garage. And I'm 8 miles from Clearbrook. My nearest neighbor is 3/4 of a mile away. And if I was to bear that cost as one individual, it wouldn't happen. And so that's the concern that I have, and I'm reassured that that's not going to be impacted.
That is correct.
Mr. Kennedy, you.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to, I guess, provide a rebuttal answer. I would suggest that the answer you're hearing from the industry is at best half the answer, or maybe it's an answer to the wrong question, because we shouldn't be asking, is that line going to go away? And you shouldn't be hearing an answer that, no, nobody's going to take that line away from you. The question is really, how much is that line going to cost for service? Because after this bill is passed, if you're at the end of the line, if geography, if the cost of servicing you dictates that it's going to be a lot more than servicing somebody in Minneapolis, the phone companies can now charge accordingly. And so the person who is in that situation, which is why we keep focusing on Greater Minnesota, it's not that it's only going to apply there, but these problems are magnified there because of geography. Those customers are going to be able to be charged a lot more for basic local phone service. This is not for, you know, the advanced services that many companies offer. We're talking just plain telephone service that people rely on for safety. And so that's one of the key points that I think was missing from the answer that you're being given. It's not simply a question of will it be taken away, but it's also how much is it going to cost. And I guess the other rebuttal I would briefly offer to the conversation that was just going on here is the world is changing, and I think all of us who are expressing serious concerns about the bill certainly understand that, and we're not suggesting that, you know, time should stand still and we must preserve the copper phone line system just for the sake of preserving it. Things are changing, but you have the PUC, the experts in the field, to deal with what that means in terms of how telephone service should be priced and how that's going to be borne by the customers that still subscribe to that service. We don't need to worry about the telephone companies. This is a regulated utility. They can be guaranteed a profit under our system, and that can continue to be true as the number of customers dwindle. Now, will that eventually become a problem that even the PUC might not have the golden answer to, and might there need to be a change in the future to how all of this works? Certainly. Everybody can see it's moving in that direction, but it hasn't happened yet, and this is not the answer.
Yeah, any other? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, two questions. First, to the bill section. To the end, Senator Sparks or Mr. Christensen, they're getting rid of the supermajority for a referendum on municipality. What's the reason for that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, that was a Senator Schmidt provision that was added. Maybe he could speak to that.
Senator Schmidt.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, you raise a good question here. And as we look to promote broadband access and infrastructure around Minnesota, it's become clear that one of the barriers for deriving a local match and a local contribution to that effort is language that's found in 237.19. And that's what this Section 5 of the bill relates to. It removes a century-old provision in law that requires a supermajority for local units of government to build or expand telephone switches. And even though nobody is investing in telephone switches, that's essentially traditional telephone service these days, it is perceived as a barrier in law. And it does cause some problems for local units of government who are looking to partner with cooperatives or providers in deriving a local match for a partnership. It serves as a barrier for making those investments. So we just want to remove that language from law, and that's what we've proposed to do in this bill.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt, thanks for that. The reason I ask, I know there's been efforts to do that. I think it's been a good balance in that it doesn't easily have a government entity getting into what can be an expensive endeavor for the taxpayers. And so I guess I've always been somebody that likes to see the higher threshold before you get a knee-jerk reaction and all of a sudden the taxpayers are on the hook. So I'd raise concern about that. That I'd like to see us keep that in law. But a comment was made about universal service, I think it was James from the AG, would be going away. And can you elaborate on why you indicated that this could be the beginning of universal service? Because I don't quite see that in the bill.
Mr. Kennedy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yes, thank you for the question. I believe I referred to universal service and in the sense of universal access and carrier of last resort, which is at issue in this bill, by which I mean the concept of every person in Minnesota having universal access to affordable basic telephone service is going away with this bill, is being jeopardized by this bill. I think maybe the confusion in the question comes from I was not referring to the Universal Service Fund, which is federal payment and subsidization for expanding telephone service in the state. I was not saying that that went away or was changed by the bill.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. And to that issue, and you kind of addressed it, I mean, what happens when the incumbent carrier is down to 20 or 10% of the market share, or the amount of, I don't know what age group, you pick it, 40 and under, somewhere 25 and under, 35 and under. I mean, they are cutting the cord incredibly fast. And I talked to my local telephone companies who are part of MTA, and the number of landlines are dropping rapidly. And so that does create an issue, as you kind of addressed one of your later comments here.
Is that a local telephone?
I think that was a CLECT. My landline wouldn't make it in here. No, and I really appreciate the discussion, because I think we're all walking this balancing act, and we know the importance of it, especially in rural Minnesota. But at some point, the ILECs are going to get very, very expensive if we don't change some of their regulations, and we just let the competitors come in and eat their lunch, and then all of a sudden we're subsidizing the ILECs just so we have them. Yet if we would have reformed and changed things along the way, which is part of what this bill is proposing to do, they would have kept a competitive, a healthy part of the market share, and so we don't subsidize a situation where all of a sudden you've got ILECs being subsidized just because we want to keep that type of service in a place, and they don't have enough customers to really spread it out among each other. How do we avoid that situation?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, the best answer I have to that question, and obviously you're raising a complicated issue, but you're directly on the trail that I think this issue raises here, if you follow it out to its logical conclusion. As we keep having fewer and fewer customers, the costs get spread over fewer and fewer people. Mm-hmm. So the best answer that I have to that is we continue to leave that to the PUC until this becomes a problem that doesn't work anymore. And as I said before, we are not there yet. There's certainly, you could say, the writing's on the wall as to the fact that things are headed in that direction. I guess one observation I would offer up is things change rapidly. Not that many years ago, we wouldn't have been able to sit here and even contemplate that this would be an issue. We don't know what the future is going to bring. So I would suggest we leave this to the PUC. They will continue setting prices that are fair for consumers, spreading them out over consumers, and also ensuring that the company is getting what it's supposed to get. If that becomes a problem in 5 years, 10 years, or in the future, that should be dealt with then.
So last comment, Mr. Chair, and your reaction to this and then Senator Sparks or the industry. Have you looked at a sunset clause in this bill if it were to move forward, say 5, 6, 10 years out, and the legislature is forced to bring it back and review it? If what you say from the AG's office and ARP holds true, that will have legislative political persuasion, and if it's not true, it will prove that maybe the competitive marketplace is working. But in 10 years or 8 years or whenever the sunset would be, everything would revert back to this if the sunset doesn't pan out. What are your reactions to that, and has a sunset clause been looked at?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum, there's already a provision that we don't have to wait for a sunset. If an area becomes re-regulated or a competitor moves out, then the Public Utilities Commission on its own can re-regulate that telephone company.
Senator Schmidt, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just had a couple of comments, and I appreciate the fact that we're grappling with this, and this is a difficult issue. It's nuanced. I think we recognize that it's a difficult environment out there. When you look at the way we receive technology, and whether it's voice service or others, we have traditional telephone companies. We're hearing from them. We also have internet service providers and cable companies, and each is regulated in different ways. And I think that's a big crux of the problem that we're dealing with today. Is it's not competitive necessarily for one competitor to be regulated in one way and another competitor to be regulated in a different way. And I think that's really what's bringing this issue to our attention today. And as you look at, you know, the landscape we have throughout Minnesota, this is certainly true throughout the country, we don't have ubiquitous service. There was an effort 100 years ago to make sure everybody had access to electricity. There was a similar effort to make sure that everybody had access to landline telephones. But in the modern day, we don't have that effort to make sure that everybody has access to internet service or VoIP or you know, the telephone or you know, cable or I'm not sorry, telephone data or other services that many of us do enjoy. The landscape is very skewed and different. And I think that's what makes it very challenging for us to address this. We're, instead of, you know, trying to settle in the middle here, we're lowering, I think, the bar in regulation. And one might say that that's justified. I don't know if that's justified today, though, when you have so much of Minnesota, 40% of greater Minnesota, I think, lacks access to broadband at our state speed goals. 20% of Minnesota as a state whole lacks that access. And we're trying to strike this balance between having regulation that's appropriate for the 21st century, but also create an environment that spurs on investment. And so I think a lot of this discomfort, if you will, is a recognition on our parts that we're not necessarily there yet. And this may be jumping the gun. I certainly sympathize with what we're hearing from our providers in the room, though. This regulation and how we regulate different competitors in different ways is not necessarily right. I guess I would just comment, I wish that this would be part of a larger effort, not only to recognize that in some cases more regulation is appropriate, in others less regulation may be appropriate, but also this is part of that infrastructure discussion that we've been having here in Minnesota. This whole conversation would be much easier if all of Minnesota were connected, you know, through internet service, you know, of the 21st century. We're meeting our state speed goals. I think this might be moot in some cases if we had that level of connectivity around the state. The challenge, though, is trying to re-regulate, if you will, deregulate, if you will, however you want to look at it, in an environment where not everybody has the same level of access. And so I guess I would just emphasize the fact that the challenge we're having with this bill fits in with the broader conversation we've had at the legislature the last couple of years about broadband connectivity throughout the state. And to address the concerns that a lot of us have raised today with how this bill would play out in reality, those concerns are remedied if we're investing in high-speed connectivity and broadband infrastructure. And so I hope folks make that connection because I think it's so important for us to recognize that. If we're able to connect all of Minnesota and there is truly competition, you know, from traditional land carriers, from cable companies, from internet service providers in markets across the state, the sorts of concerns that are raised today, I think, become less important. And so that's a point I just want to make make here today and get on the record. And you know, I do, you know, recognize that this is, a conversation that we're going to continue to have as technology evolves. But at the end of the day, never has it been more important for folks to be connected, and never has it been more important for us to ensure basic consumer protections. And I think that balance is what we need to strike.
Any other comments or questions, Senator Rood?
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's important to look at the fact that we've been this is not the first time a lot of us have seen this bill, and we've been working on this for a long time. I think this strikes a very good balance. And I think it's important to say, you know, let's not wait until 5 and 10 years until we're in crisis mode. We have an opportunity here to move ahead. This is a solution we've been working on for quite a long time. And we never make good decisions when we're in crisis mode. We aren't in that mode now. We have the opportunity to work on this. We have worked on this. And I think this is a good solution that should go forward to allow our small telephone companies to be competitive and stay in business and not wait 5 to 10 years before they are out of business and in crisis and we lose jobs.
Does anybody else need to comment? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I do have some serious concerns on the consumer protections that everybody raised. I would urge the stakeholders to continue discussing if this moves forward. As pointed out, the competitive criteria, I think if you have in this bill one set of criteria and then in Chapter 237.761, Subdivision 5, some additional competitive tests, if you have conflicting things in law, I just don't think that's good law. So I don't know if the stakeholders have looked at that about possibly amending that to put some of that criteria in there. I, you know, urge you to keep doing that. In the Subdivision 7, the reexamining of when they could be called back under the PUC, I think you need to, you know, fine-tune that a little more to make sure that legally holds up, because I think there is some questions of you know, one day it passes and then it doesn't really get into the criteria. It's just, you know, the commission on its own can say, oh, we don't like that, call us back. We don't, the competitive rule is working. So I think you need to do that in some little more, some more. And so I think there's, you know, still some work that could be going, and you do have some time. So I urge you to keep working on it.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, there's no doubt, fewer people have landlines. I get the competitive pressure that the ILECs are under. But we can be sure of a couple of things. People are going to, under this scenario, people are going to be paying more for their telephone service and are going to have lower quality. We opened up the hearing with that, you know, with that being confirmed on the record by one of the ILECs. If, you know, some of the provisions that Mr. Elwood mentioned were buttoned up a little tighter and understood that some of the service quality aspects, the market tests that Senator Desick just cited, some of the pricing controls were a little more well tended to in this proposal, I might take a closer look at supporting it. But we know that people's phone bills are going to go up and their service is going to go down. We got a great speech on the floor yesterday about the war on the poor that my bill represented. We have all kinds of anxiety when there may be an impact on energy utility ratepayers of, you know, fractions of cents. I wish there was some consistency in considering what people pay on their bills from bill to bill to bill.
Okay. Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, I would just write to address the fact that I think it's a matter of opinion whether the rates will go up and the service will go down. I think we've heard testimony both ways, and I think that's really subjective and a matter of opinion because I don't believe that to be a fact.
Anybody
else? Chair.
Senator Dibble.
We have nothing that calls for tending to those issues, and we have past experience to guide us.
I think we asked that question. I don't know that we got a good answer to it. Senator Sparks.
Well, Mr. Chair, and obviously we've had a long debate, and I appreciate everyone taking the time. I mean, we've been meeting quite a bit, and I obviously appreciate you folks here. We'll certainly be willing to continue to meet with the stakeholders. But, you know, when we deregulated the four lines, we heard the same kind of scenario that rates were going to go up, and that didn't happen. Iowa and Wisconsin, we talked a lot about California, but our neighboring states went even further than this bill did back in 2004 and 2006. They had no interruptions in service of existing landlines, and in fact, new services continued to grow. So we'll continue to keep working with it. 36 other states have passed reform that goes a lot farther than this. So I think we're just trying to get this right. Obviously, members are free to do what they want today, but obviously it's an important topic, and just by the discussion we had here today, we'll see what the committee likes to do, but obviously we'd like to continue to work on it.
Okay, so Senator Sparks moves Senate File 736 as amended. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. That'll be referred to finance also. So with that, members, meeting adjourned.
Got my notes?
Yeah, sure.